He's uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
Hello out there on the internet. It's me, Matthew. I am here with Emily Lipstein and
Jason Kebler.
And it's a special episode. It's going to be a long episode today. We are saying goodbye to the man who created Cyber, our editor-in-chief, the man who shaped Motherboard. It is Jason's... Can we say it's your last day? How much can we say, Jason?
You can say it's my last day. That's accurate.
It's
my last day.
Jason, it's your last day. So it's going to be a little bit of a different episode. We're going to spread it out, I think, over a couple of recording sessions if you're listening to the podcast. If you're watching us record it live, it's just one big sad farewell. We're going to get into some deep Motherboard lore. We're going to talk about some of Jason's favorite stories. We're going to get into it. But of course, first we're going to talk about some current events. And that's it. That's all I wanted to do. Just Jason, a little podcast table setting.
A 10 part series.
Yeah. It's like, remember like those commercials for like the World books where it's like, you know, this like 27 volume set can be yours for 50 payments of $100 or whatever.
It's the very,
if anyone wants to do 50 payments of $100, please let me know.
I think Vice won't be bankrupt if that happens. I think all of our financial problems will be solved.
That'll finally put us over the edge. It'll be great. So please, we're asking for as little as a cup of coffee a day.
Should I start singing Sarah McLachlan, or is that like
that's the outro? I want Graduation by Vitamin C. That's okay. What I want.
We can arrange that.
Was that your, what was your high, was that the what they played at your high school graduation? Was Vitamin C, was that the song that they played over the sad photographs of like the whole class, or do you remember?
I don't remember, but it is the song that I most stereotypically associate with that. So I'm going to say it probably was. Mostly because it's called Graduation.
Yeah, I feel like every graduation since that song came out, that song has played. So Vitamin C really did a lot to, I don't know, keep themselves relevant every June.
I got just under May, the wire.
I would say to this day, like, I still hear that song a lot in these contexts.
I got just under the wires. We were Green Day, Time of Our Lives.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Dude, when the first video that I ever made as like a 13-year-old or something with my digital camera was photos of my sister, like as a baby, because my sister is 11 years younger than me and I had just gotten a digital camera. So I took pictures of her like as a baby and then set it to Good Riddance by Green Day and in like Windows Movie Maker and created just a very emotional, you know, just a beautiful piece of art that I don't think I might have put it on like Photo Bucket or something.
Fuck, Photo Bucket. Can't remember the last time I thought about Photo Bucket. So you're going, so hurricanes, Emily, yeah. You're going to be gone next week.
Yeah, so I'm going to be gone the next 2 weeks. So y'all are going to have to deal without me and enjoy Matthew's wonderful company. But yeah, I'm going out west. And I am very excited about that because I'm like, wow, I'm going to get to enjoy like the best weather. I'm going to be, you know, like central-ish California, go down to like the Bay Area a little bit, then go up north to the Pacific Northwest. And so while I'm arriving, another person, I guess we can, I don't know, someone else is going to be arriving and that person's Hillary. Not that Hillary, the Hurricane Hillary. And so, I say it's funny, but in like an ironic way, like, because it's like, oh, go to California, encounter a hurricane for the first time that I can remember in California. Thankfully I won't be in the place where it's likely to make landfall. And by the time that the weather system gets up to where I'm going to be, it's just going to be like scattered, whatever. But it should be, I'm just like, damn, truly best laid plans.
What's the
so?
Sorry,
I was just gonna say, yeah, it is very rare for a hurricane to come through California. However, there was a tropical storm last year, and last year they're like, "Oh, this is so rare." So, you know, that's 2 years in a row. I'll say that first of all. Second of all, I hope everyone stays safe. I hope so no true. One gets flooded. I hope nothing bad happens. But as Samir's pointed out in the comments, swell of the year, baby.
Swell of the year.
Swell of the year.
So, what's the surf report? What's the surf weather guy saying?
So it's like, it's very touch and go because it's unclear like where it's going to hit exactly, but waves are decent right now. Waves are supposed to be super good tomorrow and Sunday. Hurricane probably going to hit us sometime Monday, at which point the waves will be huge, but probably too windy to actually like do anything. And at that point, dangerous.
Yeah, like actual danger versus like dangerous, man. Nice.
Yeah, like the days like preceding the hurricane are usually like really fun. And the hurricane often produces offshore winds, which are somewhat rare, at least in LA, and are good for surfing. So all my friends are stoked with the caveat that, you know, we hope no one gets hurt. But that's I mean, I know that I've been on here for surfing before and like have talked with Samir about surfing, have surfed with Samir, but it's a thing in surf communities where it's like, hope that hurricane doesn't hurt people, but also super excited about this hurricane, you know?
That's also like how the storm chaser people are. They're like, damn, this sucks, but also fuck yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the entirety of surf like forecasting is just tracking swells and tracking storms and hoping that storms will hit like the opportune parts of the ocean to create good waves for you. So, you know, I've been updating the forecast every like 2 hours. At one point it said there was going to be 20-foot waves like by my house, but now it's down to like 4 or 5. So we'll see. I mean, that changes constantly. That's a
big discrepancy. Yeah.
It's a big discrepancy. Yes. 20-foot waves are like cower, you know, run for my life vibes. Don't go anywhere near the ocean.
No. God.
Have either of you ever?
But, like, yeah. So Emily, is it gonna ruin your trip or what?
It won't.
Be fine.
So yeah. So like this, I had like a bit of an anxiety like 30 minutes last night. My roommate is from the LA area, and she was like, "Oh yeah, it's gonna be a Category 4 storm." And my thought is, being someone from the Northeast who has ridden out hurricanes before, has been like. Like when I hear it's going to be a Category 4, I assume that what she means is it is going to be a Category 4 when it hits land. That is not the situation. It is not at this point, the models are not showing that it is going to be a category. It's going to be maybe a Category 2 if when it hits Baja, which is still bad. Like just because it's a Category 2 doesn't mean that it's not extremely dangerous, potentially life threatening to the people that are in the path of the storm. However, I'm going to allow myself to be a little bit self-centered as I am thinking about how this hurricane will impact me, the center of the universe. But it's like, I'm not going to be anywhere near where the hurricane is going to hit. And I might even get to avoid some of like the rain that's going to be brought in, and maybe the rain will be good. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, like I know the rain's going to be bad in Death Valley.
This is classic, like recording days before something happens, and then some of it's going to come out after it. And let's just cross our fingers.
Yeah, Matt, how can you edit a podcast after the fact?
I mean, I can. I suppose
this is a catastrophe. Please prevent us from being canceled.
Maybe it would be good to be canceled. Maybe it would be nice to be canceled while I'm off the grid for 2 weeks.
Yeah, if you're going to do it, that's a good time.
I don't know. There's
Yeah, too much rain in a drought area is really bad. It's going to be really bad flash flooding in like Death Valley, Joshua Tree, like that area. Like, this is not to make light of what might happen there. This is simply discussing the weather. But yeah, I'm like, wow, going to California to experience nice weather, nice West Coast weather, and bringing a hurricane with me.
Yeah, we had 2 months of very good weather, and that's it this year. It was like rain until April, rain through May, actually, then like June, July, very nice, and now fog and storms in August. So I don't know, whatever. That's my life.
Yeah, Matt, when was the last time you had to ride a hurricane? There was like something last year, right? I feel like there was something that was hitting the Carolinas last year.
It's funny because it's every year, essentially. We have like a big hurricane season here every year. And Karen, my wife, works for one of the companies that like monitors it. So there's usually like a week every year where she's in a bunker somewhere as part of like an emergency response team, like coordinating people. But the last, and that's usually predicted to be bad, and then it's usually okay. The worst one, I think, was maybe 2016, 2017, right after I'd moved here. And it was right around the time I'd started working at Motherboard. And the worst thing that happened was, like a transformer blew up in the backyard, and I happened to be outside, like watching the weather when it happened. And like a tree, got hit by the wind so hard that it went into the transformer and exploded. There's no fires or anything. It was just really cool and loud. And that's as bad as it'd been. A couple years before that, before I'd gotten here, there was a really bad storm that hit. And the floods were so bad afterward that it destroyed large parts of the city. Flooded out a bunch of stuff. But, you know, that was a once in a century storm. We'll probably have another one in a few years. It was one of those kinds of situations.
So we don't try.
Yeah. Do we want to move on to other things on the internet this week?
I think we should. Okay. What do you want to hit first?
So I feel a little embarrassed. I want to talk about Planet of the Base, which until yesterday when I actually sat down and watched the video, I assumed was just a real song and did not know that it was a parody.
It is a real song. It is now a real song. It was performed live at a Jonas Brothers concert.
It was performed live at Mood Ring also.
What's Mood Ring?
Yes, exactly. My friends ran that event.
Mood Ring is a hype bar in Bushwick. Very cool. Have been several times. Was the least cool person there.
Emily, I think you've been tracking
this.
It's
a good bar.
Obviously a little bit closer than I have. What is this thing? And why is the 90s punishing us all?
I don't see this as punishment. I see this as celebration. Basically, Planet of the Base is just like a parody song that's real. It started out as like a clip that was posted to like TikTok, Instagram, Twitter. It really took off on Twitter. That's like a Eurodance parody where it's like, you know, all of the biggest music producers of like the late 90s, early 2000s, and even into the 2010s, you know, that produced like, you know, the Max Martins, et cetera, made all of these songs that really didn't make any sense lyrically. You know, if you ever actually sat down and think about like the Backstreet Boys, I Want It That Way, it doesn't make sense. The lyrics are just words. They're just words that like one could think of it as like, you know, some like postmodern poetry, whatever, etc. But yeah, no, Planet of the Base basically takes the like Aqua.
It's very Barbie Girl.
Barbie World.
Eiffel 65 was my Euro trash dance. Eurovision dance band. I don't know. But I feel like Backstreet Boys are like Pulitzer Prize winning lyricists compared to, you know, Aqua and Eiffel 65, etc. Not that we need to get into that, but it's like it's a very specific type of like European electronic dance music, but not like EDM. Like,
yeah, it's Europop.
Pre-EDM.
It's different. There's usually like a female lyricist, like a female singer that's coming in, and like a gruff voiced man. It's do either of you remember the Rednecks? Or are you both too young? There is a Europop band like in this kind of style called the Rednecks. And they dress like Appalachian hillbillies. And they had a big hit in like I think the mid to early 90s called Cotton Eye Joe. That was just like an Americana, an old Americana standard that they put like a dance beat behind. And it's terrible.
That was a Europop band?
Yeah.
Euro dance?
Yeah. And it's funny because they were like created by some Swedish people. And it's one of these things where there's not actually any members. They just hire different people to come in and be the to put on like bad teeth and wear a floppy hat and be a member of the Rednecks. I think the last I heard from them, they were still around and like some, they were trying to sell the band on the internet. You could spend like $2 million and buy the brand, the Rednecks.
I'm pretty speechless over here. First of all, that you said, do you know the Rednecks as the band? Because it's like everyone knows Cotton Eye Joe. Like, no way would I have ever known.
Yeah, you leading with, that. Do you know who wrote Cotton Eye Joe?
I wouldn't say they wrote it.
Okay, do you know who made it popular among the current generation?
I guess that is
Jock Jams. ESPN did that.
Yeah. I guess it's bad that I knew the story of the band behind Cotton Eye Joe.
I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that that's an incredible, like, Trivial Pursuit moment.
So I see this Planet of the Base thing.
I thought that Cotton Eye Joe just, like, emerged fully formed from, like, an algorithm. Like a 1990s algorithm that that is proprietary. It was, like, a supercomputer, like, proto version of what we're seeing today. And like, I did not know that there are humans behind it in any way, shape, or form.
In the same way that the hamster dance also was, like, how did this happen? It just did. It simply did.
It just simply fully formed as a thing that played behind animated GIFs on websites under construction.
Exactly.
Now I've got that stuck in my head, and I'm going to have it stuck in my head all day.
Emily, do you like Planet of the Base?
What's your Planet of the Base take?
Okay.
I think it's really good, and I also can't stop singing it in the house, and that is, you know, causing strife in my household. But it's great. There was, like, the original, like, it's not only, like, did the song itself become a meme, but the video and the promotion of it became a meme. Where it's like they kept swapping out like the female singer and pretending that Miss Biljana Electricana was the same person but was actually different people. And then this was made canon in the actual final music video, which is extremely good, extremely 90s. Like, you know, I don't think we can watch it on here for, you know, copyright claim purposes, but it truly is excellent.
So I have a question for you, which is I woke up at 3 a.m. the other day with that song stuck in my head and I couldn't fall back to sleep for like an hour at least. I'm a big fan. The original TikTok that went ultra viral on Twitter is really good. I like this guy, Kyle Gordon. Like I've followed him on TikTok for a while. He's very funny. His characters are very funny, like, for the most part. I don't know. Maybe he's bad. I don't know. Who can say? But the things that I've seen are funny. And this went like mega viral, like super viral, like took over the internet viral. And then he did this thing that everyone does where he's like, full release coming in like 2 weeks. Or like 10 days or whatever, like the full version of the song. And this gave him time to sort of like build up the lore. He like went to Croatia at one point and like filmed this teaser video where, as you said, he replaced Biljana Electronica. Then the full music video dropped, etc. My personal feedback, and I want to hear what you guys think, is like, if you go that viral of a snippet, I'm dropping the full thing the next day. Like, I just feel like I feel like the moment was perhaps missed because we're talking about it now. Last I checked on YouTube, it had like 3 million views or something. Maybe it has way more. And maybe he knows more about the internet and promoting things than I do. But for me, I was like, oh, he should have dropped this like immediately. Like I'm checking now, the video has 1.3 million views on YouTube. And it's like, had he dropped the full music video like the next day, it's like song of the summer in every club, cannot escape it. Like that's my personal feeling. But I don't know. What do you guys think?
So he was actually he initially said that the full song was coming out on the 22nd. It's the 18th today. So he ended up pushing it earlier to, I think it was the 15th when the full thing dropped. So I think he realized that to an extent, but like, if we're going to, you know, break the fourth wall a little bit, I think that there needed to be time to actually film that music video because there was no way in hell that the song was complete outside of just that clip. Right. And that music video was not even a thought, when that snippet went out. Cause like what they filmed in the Oculus in, you know, lower Manhattan. Yeah, and Jules is in the chat saying that they opened for the Jonas Brothers in Boston and nobody knew who they were, which is so funny to me. And I love that. Because I think another part of, you know, the zeitgeist with this is that it was a TikTok, but it went viral on Twitter.
It did go viral on TikTok. That's really brutal, by the way. It's brutal to me. It's brutal to like, it means that only old people think it's funny. Only millennials exactly. think it's funny.
Well, exactly it.
Yeah,
or
because
get it or have any interest. It's like not viral at all on TikTok. I saw it on TikTok and it has like a million views or something, but it has like 40 million views on Twitter or something. Like it's mega viral on Twitter.
Well, I think to like get the joke, you have to remember stuff like Cotton Eye Joe and Barbie Girl and like that weird 90s 2000 era like music, and the TikTok skews younger, and like this is not what Europop sounds like anymore, right? I mean, there's still some of this stuff, yeah. But this is very much like a 90s parody. It's hitting a very specific kind of millennial nostalgia. I also agree with Emily that I don't think they had like they didn't know that this was going to go, you know, mega viral. They just they struck while the iron was hot and probably got this thing out as quickly as they could, I would imagine.
Can I read some YouTube comments?
Please.
So the YouTube comments on this video are just like beautiful because everyone is fully leaning in. User Waddles Plays says August 15th, 1994. I will never forget how crowded the mall was that day that this released. The smell of popcorn, the screaming, so much promise, hope, so much bass. You just had to be there. Another, user Shiv421 Cobra says, I was 15 when DJ Crazy Times represented Estonia at Eurovision with this banger. Still absolutely devastated that this didn't win. Whereas I think my favorite comment has disappeared, but it was someone who was basically able to emulate the perfect like boomer, like Eastern European boomer mom, like commenting on a YouTube video cadence and like use of language. Bless you. And it's just like, so, yeah, I used to listen to this song every single day back in 1997 on our Lithuanian communist farm. I'm still mad that this didn't win Eurovision 1997. I remember when my friends and family from Yugoslavia came to visit and they played this song from a cassette recorder. Like just like extremely like
building God lore,
these comments, like making lore and being like trying to retcon this as being like a real song. And I love that. It's just, it's so funny to me. I really enjoy it.
The lore is really good. I read a Rolling Stone interview with him, with Kyle Gordon, DJ Crazy Times. And he said that he's releasing an entire album of parody songs, but each is parodying a different genre. And this is the first one. And it's like, the interview is good. Kyle is like a very self-aware person. He's been doing this character for a long time. He has a lot of characters. He's a professional comedian, has been doing this for a long time. I'm very curious as to whether the CD that he speaks of, the album, was actually gonna be a thing before this one mega viral. There's like no way, right?
No way in hell. Yeah. No way in hell.
Yeah, no, absolutely not.
Like, oh, yeah, I've been working on this for like a long time. Like, it's part of a this like much larger concept that I have that I've been working on. I'm like, yeah, okay, okay.
No, you're leaning into the thing that works for sure. It got you in front of the, it got you to open for the Jonas Brothers. You're banking everything on that.
Look, the writer's strike has impacted us all. And it's important to diversify during these difficult times as we're fighting the studios.
All right, Cyber listeners, we're going to pause there for a break. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, cyber listeners, we are back on with Jason Kebler saying goodbye to Motherboard's editor-in-chief. I think that's a decent transition, like fighting the studios, fighting those Richmond north of Richmond.
We're going to talk. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's just music themed. Another piece of music went viral. This one more earnest, if perhaps still extremely online. And I wanted to talk about this. I don't know how much of either of y'all are following this because it's country music kind of centric. Are either of you
following? I'm a country fan.
Okay. Oliver Anthony. Yeah. How do you feel about the Richmond north of Richmond, Jason?
So I listened to it once. It is catchy. He's very angry. I saw that Gucci Mane wants to sign him to his label. At least perhaps that's what he posted on Instagram. I know that there is a lot of people are like, this is an industry plant / this is like an astroturfing campaign, which is maybe what you want to talk about.
Kind of.
There's a YouTube playlist where he has like conspiracy videos, etc. My feedback is that the song is like okay. The message of the song is very like Jan 6 coded lyrics, language, etc. But I will say it's like catchy in terms of there are like a lot of like Trump songs,
yeah,
like Trump artists and stuff, and I would say that in terms of just like the musicality of this one, it's not like great, but it is better than the average. It's like the Operation Underground Railroad movie of country music.
That's a really good comparison. I don't think he's an industry plant. I think this is a real guy that was making a real song and got filmed, and it blew up. To give people background in case they don't know, Oliver Anthony is a guy. He's just a guy that lives in the South. Apparently, unless we find out later that he's an industry plant, which does happen in these times.
He is a rich man north of yeah. Richmond.
I just don't get that vibe, though. But he has a song called the Richmond North of Richmond, which is like an old school country sounding song about how your dollar doesn't go as far as it used to. And there's an Epstein joke in there. And it's catchy. And it blew up online after like some people of the conservative like influencer space kind of latched onto it and retweeted it and said like this, you know, this is the real America and like we're all feeling this, et cetera, et cetera. And like all of that stuff felt like very forced. And it irritated me, especially because I am a huge fan of country music. I listen to a lot of country music. I listen to a lot of contemporary country music. And there's a lot of really great country music that's been made in the last 5 years that sounds like this, but just better. And this ain't it. This is bad. The Operation Underground Railroad comparison is good because like it's okay, but it's not This isn't Tyler Childers. This isn't Sturgill Simpson.
No,
this is not the same. This is not on the same level. He put out a Facebook post recently that's pretty long, where he kind of talks about who he is, and says like, he's not super interested in like a record deal. There's nothing special about me. I'm not a good musician. I'm not a very good person. Spent the last 5 years struggling with mental health and using alcohol to drown it. And like, maybe this is where you end up finding out that this guy is a character, but there's just something about it that does strike me as sincere. And that he just went viral because it seems like he's gotten a lot of like viral. He's gotten a lot of like conservative online memes that he placed into the song. And that's what caught on with people, you know? So,
yeah. So I definitely think he's real. I think the song is real, but I don't think that the excitement around it is fully organic, if that makes sense, which is like hard to say. Yeah. It's hard to parse, but it's like immediately it was like grabbed by like the right wing megaphone and turned into like a culture war thing. And so it's very hard to say like who is listening to this because they think it's a good song and who is listening to it because the liberal media told you not to because it's racist or whatever, which I'm not saying that it is. I don't know what the lyrics are, TBH, but it's like that sort of like they don't want you to listen to it, so you have to support it.
It is
like there's definitely some of that happening.
Like that's what irritated me because it's like these people had never heard they had not heard a country song in 10 fucking years. Because there is all this great stuff about what it's like to live in those parts of the country and the troubles and travails of that are really good and really well done and sound beautiful, but aren't, you know, talking about Epstein Island.
Everyone's listening to Morgan Wallen.
I've tried with him. Setting aside like recent controversies, I just can't do it. I can't get into him. I've tried a couple times. So I think the other thing I think it's interesting that the other big country hit of the year is a cover of Fast Car that sounds pretty similar to the original version of Fast Car.
God. The like discourse about that Fast Car cover is truly something, and I don't have enough feelings about it to like be on any particular side of it, but I'm just like,
because I like Luke Combs and it's an okay cover.
Yeah,
but it's an okay cover. Way worse than the original, and it's
the original is significantly better.
It really is. It really is. He like. Yeah. It's funny because he changes so little, you know, that it's just, you listen to it and you're just like, well, I guess I should just listen to the original because it's better. This is fine. And yeah, Luke Combs is good. But this was obvious. I think this was supposed to, the Fast Car was supposed to be like a toss away on the album. I don't think they were even thinking about making it a single. And then it kind of blew up. Anyway, we'll get sucked into like a long discussion about that. Cause I don't want to get into the discourse around Fast Car specifically. I should never have brought it up. I've got one more topical thing I wanted to ask you about, Jason, before we dive into memory lane, if that's all right.
Yeah, I'm, you know, whatever you want, man, whatever you want.
Captive audience.
So I know you follow like economy and money news much more closely than I do, right? Or did. You're looking panicked right now.
I mean, you could say anything right now and I don't know what the next word usually I know where you're going with something, but no, please.
Economic
see where this goes.
Economic indicators seem to be good. Why does the economy feel so bad? That's my only question is like everything, like everyone's still complaining about the price of eggs. Inflation is still up yet. People who know things about the economy keep telling us that it's good and that the jobs are Everyone's got a job, et cetera, et cetera. Do you have any, have you have any idea what I'm talking about?
I can take a stab at it, which is just to say, so as people who are watching and listening to this already know, this is my last day at Vice. The last 2 weeks, I've had a lot of like getting people caught up to speed for what comes next and not a whole lot of reading economic news. So this may be slightly outdated, but I can give you a vibes based answer, which I feel perfectly comfortable guessing at.
That's exactly what I want, actually, is a vibes based answer.
One, I think that the job market is not that great, and it's like good in specific industries and very bad in other industries. It's very bad in media, for example, which is very selfish of us to talk about, but it's like there's tons of layoffs in both tech and in media. There is a few really big strikes, you know, with the writer's strike and the Screen Actors Guild strike, which, you know, that's the economy of Los Angeles, which is the second largest city in the United States and the most populous county in the United States. And it's like it's an actual bad thing here. There's also like, I have no data to back this up. I've not looked at the inflation numbers recently, but it's like a lot of inflation stuff is, a lot of prices have come back to normal, but some have simply not. Which is fine, I guess. Well, I don't know if it's fine or not, but it's like a bag of coffee in LA right now is like $18. It's okay, like,
I've been noticing that too here.
It's like deli meat, like a pound of turkey is like $14 at Ralph's. It's, and it's so like you can make expensive, like three sandwiches. There's like some things that are like wildly expensive right now that I think, I don't know if that, you know, makes the economy feel bad or whatever, but like I went to the grocery store the other day and I'm like, I'm not buying this turkey. Like there's no way I don't want to pay $15 for three sandwiches. And then at the same time, there's also a lot of like restaurants, at least here and also in New York, that are doing this really fucked up thing that makes really everyone really mad, where they're adding a service charge, like an 18 or 20% service charge to receipts or bills or whatever, that does not go to the workers. That is just like, this is an administrative fee. Like this is just, we're just like adding price. We're just making your food cost more and you still have to tip on top of it, which it's like, you know, I tip well, everyone should tip well, but there's like a lot of restaurants that you'll go into and then you'll get the bill and it'll be like 20% extra for like the owners.
It's like just listed as like,
I want 20% more. And
it's like miscellaneous like service fee.
Oh yeah. And sometimes they're like, this goes to employee health insurance. And sometimes they're like straight up, like, this is just for our costs. It's like, this is to like cover our costs. And it's like, that's crazy. Housing is still pretty crazy. Like rents are really bad. Like housing market to buy has come down in a few places, but the interest rates are still very high. And so I would say like vibes based, it's like, I don't know what economic indicators are saying that things are good, but I certainly feel it's like you want to buy a house, super expensive, like because you to get a mortgage, super expensive. You want to buy food, super expensive. Like there's a lot of stuff that, and like you want to get a job in tech, like good luck. You want to get a job in media or like film related industry, like good luck. Like I don't really know what parts of the job market are doing well right now, but it's like certainly not any that I'm qualified for. and so I don't know. That's my guess, but like I don't know. And the stock market is down the last week I saw. It's like down quite a lot. So I know that there's some China related reasons, like China recovery type stuff is not going well.
Also Yellow shut down or like went bankrupt, the trucking company. That's another thing.
Yeah.
And like the United Auto Workers might go on strike this fall. There's just like, the vibes are not good. I think that the vibe approach, like the vibes based approach to the economy makes a lot of sense right now, because it feels like all of the data is like things seem both good and bad, just depends on who you ask.
Yeah. I personally just want someone to like tell me exactly why deli meat is like three times as expensive as it was circa 2 years ago.
Yeah. Does anybody have in the chat have a direct line to like Mr. Boar's head? Because I would like to know.
Yeah, John Boar.
Well, I know that there are labor disputes ongoing in some poultry plants like down here. Like there's stuff that's like literally up the road from me where workers are striking that worked in poultry plants through the pandemic. And it's the same thing we're hearing everywhere, you know, getting screwed, weird and wild hours, unsafe working conditions, not enough money. Same thing that everyone's talking about. So, I mean, I'm sure that's probably.
There's also, I'll just like very quickly, a lot of companies are trying to force return to the office right now and have been for a while. And it's like not going super well. So mm-hmm. I think like worker happiness is probably down quite a lot. There's like a lot of, and then also there's all of these office spaces that companies are paying for and or just like empty. That like, that's not a great vibe. Like that someone needs to like fix that. Please someone go fix it. Like shut down all the offices and turn them into housing. I know that there's a variety of reasons why that's tricky, but that's a thing. And then also someone in the comments brought this up. Beatmaster brought this up. Record high profits are being reported, yet prices need to stay high. Like we've done quite a lot of reporting on that where it's like a lot of inflation is caused simply because companies raised the prices of things and then kept them there and blamed inflation, therefore causing inflation, but raking in like big profits. So that's definitely a big part of it too. It's just like pay us more because we want more money.
I just felt like I had to talk to you about the economy one more time. You know,
I haven't read an article about the economy in at least 3 weeks. So I apologize if that was like completely wrong, but that's my vibes based answer.
That's all we wanted. We just wanted vibes based answers.
True. Yeah. Similarly, I don't think I normally like listen to Marketplace like every day in the evenings. I don't think I've listened to Marketplace in like a couple weeks.
I mean,
not for any specific reason, just life.
It's because it's August. No one should do
anything. It is August.
No one should do anything in August. It's too hot to do anything. Everyone should just be sleeping, generally, sleeping through the day. I know that's impossible for most of us, but. All right, do we want to get into some motherboard lore? Do we want to dive into this? Yeah? Okay.
Let's do it.
Memory lane time.
Jason, this is your life, or at least the last 10 years of it anyway. How did you start at motherboard exactly?
Yeah, so for anyone who doesn't know who I am, I'm Jason Kepler. I'm the editor-in-chief of motherboard for one more day. Well, till 5 p.m. today. I've been at motherboard specifically for over 10 years. In May 2013, I was a reporter in Washington, D.C. for U.S. News and World Report. I was an intern there for a little while, and then I became a science reporter there. And the reason I became a science reporter was because I went to a science and tech high school, and therefore had taken like a genetics class. And I didn't really take any science classes in college, but I knew enough about science so that I could curate their science page, which required grabbing articles from this service called Live Science and posting them in the CMS. I didn't like write them or read them. I just selected which ones they were. At some point I was like, why don't I write articles for this section that has no employees at this publication that like has only six writers or something. And so I started writing articles about science, and I wrote a lot of articles about like, I don't know, solar flares, climate change, sea level rise. I did a big article about coffee and climate change, and how it was like impacting crop yields in Colombia, etc. And then my editor at the time was obsessed with drones, was obsessed with like the idea that drones would be flying in the United States and would be used to spy on American citizens. And I found this I found this case in North Dakota where a predator drone had been flown over this dude's compound. He was like a sovereign citizen type guy named Rodney Brossart. And a predator drone was used to fly over his ranch. And then DHS or like some federal group, or perhaps just the state police, I don't remember, this happened in like 2011, raided and took him in. And then he was released on bail. And I called him and he answered and he told me everything about what happened. And that went like pretty viral at the time, for obvious reasons. And from then on, my editor was like, okay, you know how to like report and write articles. So then from then on, I just like wrote a lot of articles about drones. I wrote a bunch of articles about the internet and Reddit and so on and so forth, because I was an internet nerd. At the same time, I had a friend named Kurt or Padich, still one of my best friends, who is not a journalist at all, but was interning for a website called Motherboard. He was studying nuclear physics at Carnegie Mellon, and he showed up at Vice's office in like 2011 and was like, hey, can I work for your website? And they were like, yeah, sure thing, which is not how it works anymore. But that's how it worked then.
No, it definitely does not work like that anymore.
Yeah. And so Kurt was one of my best friends, and he was like, why don't you write for Motherboard? And I was like, what is that? I don't know what that is. Why don't you write for Vice? And I was like, I do know what Vice is, but like, I don't know. New York seems too cool for me. I lived in DC, whatever. But at some point, I know this is a long story, but you said I could have the floor, so I'll continue.
Yeah,
talking.
Please. No, this is all important. Important backstory.
Yeah. So I was like on some jobs email listserv, which was like, here are open jobs, blah, blah, blah. And it also had emails about people who got new jobs or left places. And I got an email that mentioned that Adam Clark Estes, who worked for Gizmodo for a long time and now works somewhere very cool. I believe he works at Fox, but I might be wrong. Yeah, in any case, very good journalist. Had left Motherboard for Gizmodo. And I was like, oh, someone left Motherboard. Kurt mentioned that Motherboard was cool. I'm going to email the editor. So I emailed the editor, who is Derek Mead, who was the editor for a very long time, is now one of my best friends as well. I was like, hey, Derek, I write for US News and World Report. Can I write articles for Motherboard? And here's an idea. And he was like, yes, sure thing. And I wrote an article for him while I still worked for US News and World Report, which was not good, but that's what I did. And I sent it to him, and then he published it on the website, and he paid me like $30 or something. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to do another one. Can I do another one? And I sent it to him, and he's like, okay, here's CMS access. Can you please load it and publish it? Which, for anyone listening, CMS is like how we publish articles, like the back end of the site.
Y'all wouldn't
and
give me
one article.
It took like 3 years before y'all gave me CMS access. This is, I am upset.
This is a different time.
I had written one article and they were like, here's a login and password to do anything on Vice's website.
It's which is like the latchkey kid, like internet age. Like,
yeah. I was like, wow, I like this. They're letting me write like whatever I want. So I did a bunch of articles for like 30, 40 bucks. And I was like, I can live off of $40 an article. I quit. So I quit my job. I went to South America because, full transparency, I was dating someone at the office and we broke up. And I was like, this isn't cool. I have to quit my job. I was like 22 years old. I was just like, I don't want to see this person. It's like upsetting to me. I'm going to South America to solve my problems. So I went to South America for 3 months and I freelanced a bunch of stories from there. I would like bring a USB drive with me to hostels and stuff. I didn't have a laptop, as in, or maybe I did. I don't remember, but I would have to like go to an internet cafe, research an article, write it. What I used to do is I used to write it on my laptop with no internet, and then I would put it on a USB drive, and then I would take it to an internet cafe and file it from the USB drive, more or less, once I had internet. And I wrote a bunch of stories about like the Amazon and Ecuador. I was in Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia, and Colombia. And I wrote a bunch of stuff. I wrote one article that was, I went on a make your own cocaine tour in Colombia, which I did. And I think I was paid like $60 for that article. That was like 3,000 words long or something. And was one of the most popular stories that Vice ever did. I still get emails from people asking me like, how do I go on this tour? Like over 10 years later. In any case, I'm not mad about it. I'm just saying it was a different era. And then I moved to New York and then I got a real job at Motherboard. And I think at the time Motherboard was like 5 people. We had a lot of fun. And now it's 10 years later and I quit.
True. We're pulling up the cocaine article.
Yeah. I don't know if Twitch is going to be upset that I have, that I put that link in the chat, but,
who knows?
Yeah.
So did you, okay. So how does one, what does it cost to go on and make your own cocaine tour? Like what did you sample the cocaine at the end of the tour? Like what's the story here?
So this is from memory. Okay. The details are going to be in the article.
Yeah.
Probably.
I'm going to fact check you. Let's pull it up on the screen if we can.
So I was in Colombia, which is a wonderful country. Okay. I was backpacking, going hostel to hostel. And everyone was talking about two things. They were talking about going on ayahuasca tours in Peru and going on make your own cocaine tour in the south part of Colombia. And I was like, that sounds like a Vice thing. And so it doesn't matter anymore, but it's like, I went to the hostel that they told, I figured out what city the hostel was in. They didn't tell me the name of it, 'cause I don't think it had a name. And it's like, you got off of this taxi and you're like, take me to the special tour. And the special tour was at this place. And the guy did like tours of ruins and also took you to like a farm where you made cocaine. The coca leaves, which like coca leaves are used very widely in South America, for like coca tea and to chew them. And there's like a lot of cultural, and religious indigenous uses of coca leaves. So it's not like illegal to grow coca, but it is illegal to make cocaine. And we went to this like, I guess it was a shack. It was like a stone structure in the middle of a farm that had a stove. And literally we like picked a bunch of coca leaves off of this tree. And then we had like a kitchen counter and we chopped it up. And you put a bunch of like pretty scary chemicals into it. Which include like urea, hydrochloric acid, like battery acid. Like these are things that extract the necessary chemicals from it. And then you literally just cook it down like in a pot and stir it until it becomes a powder, like straight up. That's what happens. And it was like a brown powder. And then you put the brown powder in front of an incandescent light bulb and then it turns like bone white. And I believe it was like $60 or $80 to do this tour. And it was 3 grams of cocaine, if I recall. And the answer to like, did I sample it, et cetera, is like, I did a very, very small amount at the time because I was just like, okay, got to do it. I made it myself. Not a fan of this. Not a fan of drugs, really. Like I don't like them. They don't do well with my body. Do whatever you want, but I don't like them. And then I flushed the rest down the toilet because I was getting on a bus to Ecuador like that same day. Weirdly, I did this at like 8 a.m. or like 7 a.m. because that was the time of the tour. The tour was at like 7 in the morning. So it was like pretty.
So do you like, are you
like a party time?
Are you pouring in the chemicals? Are you like doing the like all the hard labor and the guy's just directing you? Is that how it works?
Yeah, I mean, we're making such a small amount that that it wasn't hard. It was like, it was literally like a cooking class. It was like chop, chop, chop with a knife, you know, like I think he did a couple. There was one thing that he did where he like stirred the hydrochloric acid with his hand, which was not, I don't know why he did that. I don't remember, but his hand was like kind of eroding away from years of doing this. He also told me that he like worked for Pablo Escobar for a long time, which is like, I have no idea if that's real or not. It's like, I have no way of verifying that. It was like an old man. And he may have just said that to like make the tourists feel cool. but it didn't feel like dangerous or anything. You know, it was just like, many, many, many tourists did it at the time. I have no idea if it still exists, like no clue. But I do still get emails about it.
Is that your, what's your favorite thing that you worked on?
That's definitely not my favorite thing that I worked on, like even remotely. But that is like, what, like I was, that was way before I even worked here. That was like a freelance piece. You know, I've written thousands of articles here.
Yeah, we were trying to find some and we were like, damn, there are like 500 something pages on like going back of your like articles that you've contributed to the site.
Yeah. And I've like edited many more and I've worked with really amazing people here, both of you included, which I'll say more about that at the end. I'm not trying to be sentimental at this moment, but it's like there are many eras to what I've done here.
Yeah, this is Jason's eras tour, actually.
Yeah, it's like there's the era where I wrote four articles a day about whatever, and there's the era where I wrote like mostly just investigations, and then I had my drone era where I did a lot of drone reporting. I had my era where I did tons of right to repair reporting, which is that's probably what I'm most proud of as a reporter myself, which is just like writing about consumer rights and, you know, how Apple makes it very difficult to repair iPhones. And I think I did a FOIA story about what happens to the iPhones that get recycled. They basically get shredded and turned into nothing. Like that was a pretty big story that I really liked working on. I did a very big feature about Facebook's content moderation policies back when people cared about such things. And specifically Joseph Cox on our team got a bunch of leaked documents from Facebook that showed Facebook was like allowing white nationalism and white separatism, but was not allowing what it called white supremacy. And it's like those things are fun or not. you can't distinguish between those things, but Facebook was really trying to.
There.
Yeah. So Facebook was trying to, and we did this really big, like 7,000 word story. Like I went to Facebook headquarters for like 3 days and talked to their policy people. And we had all these leaked documents and we did, you know, we worked really, really hard on it, and it got Facebook to ban all of that stuff. I mean, that doesn't mean that there's not bad things on Facebook still, but at least the policy changed to it's not explicitly allowed, which I'm pretty proud of. That said, like that article was really hard to do. I worked very hard on it, like nights, weekends, etc. And we published it, and I like had a sort of like a panic attack, anxiety relapse situation, which is fine. And like, I'm open about talking about it, but I bring this up just because it's a semi interesting story.
Just drops in the chat if anybody wants to read it.
What happened that you had? Why did you have an anxiety attack after you published?
It wasn't about the story at all. It's about the fact that I had worked so hard on it. There was like a deadline for some reason. I think we thought other people were working on the story or something. So we worked like really hard on it for like a week. Mm-hmm. And it was like a 7,000 word story, deeply reported, that took like 1 week, which is very fast.
Yeah.
And like I probably wasn't exercising, wasn't eating super well, wasn't sleeping super well. And so I published it, and then I had this like, you know, I had some like anxiety problems where I felt very uncomfortable, like coming to the office or working at all or whatever. Not blaming this on anyone. It just like, it happened. But then CNBC was like, hey, do you want to come to the New York Stock Exchange and talk about your scoop on live television today? While I was like in the midst of a panic attack. And I did, cause I was like, this is a good opportunity. So I like went to this live TV hit, which I don't, at the time, I really did not like public speaking. I wasn't very comfortable doing it. And CNBC is not the biggest channel, but it's a big channel.
Yeah.
And it was on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. So it was just like crazy, like lights and scrolling marquees and like all sorts of crazy shit happening. And I was like, dude, I'm going to like puke on air. Like, I think I'm going to puke on air. And like grace of God or something, I don't know, but the videographer, the guy who was filming me, was my old roommate, just who I hadn't seen in several years, just like happened to work for CNBC. I had no idea he was there. And he was like, hey man, like, it's going to be okay. Have a good time. And it went fine. It went great. And I was just like, okay, someone was looking out for me there. But anyways, yeah, I don't know. I could tell like a million stories like that. Not about my anxiety, because it's very under control. That was like one of the only times that it like got in the way of work. But just like got the opportunity to do a lot of crazy shit advice that I'm very thankful for, that I'm very proud of. Almost none of it that I could have done myself. But like, while I'm talking about myself, it's like, I got to go to Australia for a day. I flew from New York City to LA to go to iFixit, which I'm wearing a shirt of them right now, to do a documentary about them. And every time that a new iPhone is released, I don't know if they still do it, but they fly to Australia because of how time zones work. They like buy, it comes out first in Australia. They buy the phone the moment it goes on sale and then they tear it down. And right. So we made a video about this teardown process, and it was a really busy time at Vice. So it was, normally I'd be like, oh, let's go to Australia. I'll take some days off before and after, but I like couldn't. So I literally flew to Australia for a day to do this documentary and then came back, and I've like never been to Australia before that or since. So that was cool. I went to Cuba for 3 weeks, you know, lots of good stuff here.
We're trying to track down your CNBC thing, and we've just discovered that you've been on multiple times at the New York Stock Exchange.
Oh wow, who knew?
Yeah, you had another appearance in like 2016, 2017, talking about like Trump comments on Facebook. That's what it looks like. Yeah, similar kind of
that
thing.
One was I think that's when I wrote about the Donald on Reddit. I did like a Internet Archive fueled research report on the history of the Donald.
Was that after Reddit had kicked them out?
I also did a big story about, it was before they had kicked them out. Okay. And it was just like, this is where Donald Trump gets his memes from. And I like went into Discord where they kind of like were making them and stuff. I also did a big story about crisis actor conspiracy theories that I got to go on TV for, which was cool. Just like where the crisis actor conspiracy theory from mass shootings comes from. But it's like, I've been here for 10 years, you know, it's like, I've done a lot of stuff. So I feel very,
how did you ascend?
Hard to pick.
How did you ascend to power, Jason? How did you become editor in chief?
Yeah. So I will be nice to myself and say that I was one of our best performing writers. I was our best performing writer for a long time, in terms of just like, I wrote the most, I covered everything, I got the most traffic, which Motherboard has not ever been like traffic. Like, it's, we pay attention to it, but it's never been like our guiding force. We've always cared a lot about impact and like, are people happy and are we doing good work, et cetera. But like, I was very good at figuring out stuff that people would read. I worked here for a very long time, became a senior staff writer. Derek Mead, the guy who I mentioned earlier, had gotten promoted from being editor in chief of Motherboard to being like a global editor in chief across Vice, like across the whole newsroom.
Real quick, let me interrupt you. Real fast. Sorry. Yep. Question from Beatmaster 80 in the chat is a good one. What exactly is an editor-in-chief?
That is a good question. No, it's a good question. I mean, I think it's different at different publications, but I can talk about what my job has been. The job as editor-in-chief is to span the newsroom, which is like Matt and Emily and Joseph and Sam and all of the people that you've seen on this Twitch feed, the journalists who are writing the articles, and to like advocate for their work within the company. And also to like do the business side of things, which is, it's in journalism, generally speaking, there's a very, I mean, different publications do it differently, but basically like the journalists who cover Apple should not know if like Apple is trying to advertise on your website. Like there should be what's called a firewall between sales and editorial. And there has to be like some point of contact between the two, because otherwise, like, how would things work? Like, there just needs to be, especially at a company like Vice, where we've done a lot of like sponsored content and branded content, which we label very clearly, which I don't need to get into the specifics here, but it's like we've made video series that are funded by companies that are not about the companies, but they'll. Like we did a series called Dear Future that was sponsored by Microsoft. That was just videos about the future. And before the YouTube video, there was like a Microsoft ad. And it's like, I'm not the salesperson who's selling that, but I was going to pitch meetings where I was like, here's why you should advertise with Motherboard, because we do really important work. And here's the concept and here's how it will be executed and so on and so forth. That's like one thing that I do. I mean, ultimately the editor-in-chief is responsible for everything that's published on the site or on Twitch or on YouTube or Instagram, etc. And by responsible for, I don't mean that we do it. I mean that if shit hits the fan, it's our fault. Which is basically like we have to implement the processes that other people on the team follow and make sure that you know, if a story is very sensitive or is likely to be like legally tricky, or if, you know, it's likely to have some sort of backlash, it's to like anticipate what that might be and to edit with that in mind. And to hire people who you trust and to manage what the team does, so on and so forth. My job as editor-in-chief has been mostly that, but I've also done a lot more writing and reporting than probably most editors in chief, because I had that writing background. So I tried to write like as much as I could. And we have Emmanuel Myberg, who has been the number two guy at Motherboard for as long as I've been in charge. And he is really, really good at doing all of this stuff too. So he has been, you know, doing a lot of, it's not like I do it all by myself. And there's a lot of other people, and there's people above me who have been really great. There's people on my level across the newsroom who are really great. But like, that's basically what the job is. It's like, you're in charge of this media, this brand within a larger brand. What is the vision? Like who, what are you covering? What is the tone? Where are you, how are you going to use the your resources, which I mean that in terms of like time as a resource. It's like, are you going to spend that time doing a bunch of short articles, or are you going to spend that time doing a fewer number of longer, perhaps more reported and impactful articles? All that stuff. So yeah, that's the job. It's different at different places, but that's what I did basically.
So I'd cut you off in the middle of your story. You were one of the most popular writers
on
the site.
So Derek got promoted. There was no editor in chief. There was no editor in chief. We had a managing editor who was running the site, who was very good. I like him, and I saw him the other day, and I don't think I need to talk about who it was or whatever, but there was basically no editor in chief for a while. And this managing editor was running the site more or less, but was mostly just doing like the day to day, like how do we get through the day vibes versus the like bigger picture stuff that I just talked about. And that job was open for a long time. It was open for like 3 or 4 months. And after a few months, I was like, huh, like they haven't hired anyone. Is anyone going to do it? And then at the same time, I would say things started getting a little bit sloppier through like no one's fault really, but there was just like a kind of power vacuum where no one was in charge. And so I was like, hey, maybe I could do this. And I put my application in and I interviewed like 1,000 times and they made me write a memo and a vision and what would you do with the staff? If you had 2 more hires, like what types of people would you hire? Like what would they cover? What would they do? That sort of thing. And I got the job and it took a very long time to get it. As in, I think it was like a 4-month process or something to like finally got it. And then one day they were just like, okay, you're in charge now. and TBH, that was kind of difficult because I had gone from being I wasn't even an editor at the time. I was like a senior staff writer and people respected me and I like was friends with everyone, but it's one thing to go from just being friends with everyone to being like, hey, I'm your boss now. You got to listen to me. Which I think both of you would agree. I don't have a super confrontational leadership style. It's very encouraging good work versus being like, y'all are fucking up and have to do better. I found that that works much better, especially when you have very talented people like we do. But I was kind of like in over my head, like right when I got started. I was like, I don't know what I'm doing at all, really. And on my first day, we published a story that was bad.
What was it?
I was in an HR training about... I'll talk about it in 1 second, but okay. I was in an HR training and about how to do HR stuff, like how to like approve, like when to talk to HR, basically. Like if someone does this, then you have to come to us. Like welcome to management 101, basically. It was my first day and I finished that and then I got a call. I saw that I had like 8 missed calls.
Oh no.
That's always a good sign.
Yeah. From Disney.
Okay.
And I was like, huh.
This is
what's this about?
I have so yeah, all right. To set this up, I have wondered about this basically since I started here and have never asked and have always, I know it's not a pleasant story, but I've always kind of wanted to know what the hell happened. So I'll just say Hall of Presidents question mark. Is that where we're going?
Yeah. So even all these years later, like I want to be careful about what I say because right. not because just because, just because it's a tricky situation. In yeah. any case, we wrote an article about how Donald Trump was mad that his animatronic robot in Disney's Hall of Presidents was like not being given a long enough speech or something to this effect. I need to like find it again, but it was basically like right after Donald Trump got elected, Disney has a ride at Epcot that is called the Hall of Presidents. I don't even think it's a ride. It's like
not a ride. It's an experience.
Yes.
Yeah.
You like stand there and like George Washington is like, I founded this country or something. And
yeah, I'm happy to go into the history of it, but I think this is not the podcast for that.
In any case, they have all the presidents in there, or at least they always have the current president. And Donald Trump had become the president. And we got a tip and a pitch that was like, Disney is mad about what Donald Trump's speech says, and they want him to tone it down because it was like too angry or something like that. Something to this effect. And we published the story and it went really viral and Trump tweeted about it And Disney was like, this story is not true. And it was a story that I had not super, like, I was in the, like,
you were
chaos of being promoted and stuff. I wasn't, like, across everything in the way that I should have been. I wasn't, like, frankly, I wasn't really super aware of the story, which is not a good position to be in. And then I was in the position of trying to defend a story that I wasn't quite sure how it had been reported or anything like that. And so basically I got like extremely yelled at. And
by Disney, like you got yelled at by Disney,
dude, and by my boss.
Yeah,
for sure. Like a lot by my boss, which is fine. They were in their right to do it. It was fine. It was like normal stuff. It's like, it's not even that the story was wrong. It's that it was very difficult for us to defend the story because they were saying it was wrong and we didn't have everything like nailed down in the way that we should have, essentially. And yeah, it's just like, it was a mess and it was a very big learning experience on my first day where I was like, okay, big leagues, big deal. President tweeting about my story and about like my website in a way that he's mad. And that I learned very quickly, like the stakes of doing a site like this, or doing any journalism really. And so, that's pretty much all I want to say about it, just because it's like, it was traumatic for a lot of people on the team. Mm-hmm. And like, it was not like good, but also the story I believe was true, in the end. And it's funny because I think if it, if something like that were published now, like many years later, I don't even know that we would like bat an eye at it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't even know if it would register.
I can't imagine
quainter times.
I can't imagine coming out of like HR training, seeing the president has tweeted about something that, that you're involved in and you have missed calls from Disney. Wild.
I also like, yeah, I got on the phone with like a Disney PR person and they just like yelled at me and I was like, I don't really know what to say to you because this is like my first day. And I was just like, I'm going to try like, I'm trying to fix, don't know, need to figure it out.
Thank you for your feedback. We are listening.
Yeah. And so, you know,
can we talk about another time someone got mad at us?
Yeah, let's move on.
That's
let's
much, on. It's, this one's much funnier. Hey there, cyber listeners, Matthew here. We are putting a pause on this conversation. There's a part two. Obviously we're going to get to that very funny anecdote. It has to do with comment sections in a certain webcomic. If you want to hear that, come back next week. We've got a whole other hour with Jason. We go even deeper into old motherboard lore. We're going to talk about comment sections. We're going to talk about Shit Express and what you could buy for $10 worth of Bitcoin and what that $10 worth of Bitcoin would be worth now. And it'll be very sad. We're going to talk about a famous science fiction director getting super mad at motherboard. We've got all sorts of other great stories and kind of Jason's final thoughts on the site and on the internet in general and what the future may hold. Come back next week to get the other half of that conversation. Thank you all so much for tuning in. And we will be back next week with the rest of Jason's words.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.